cover up a crime, the evidence we obtained did not establish that the president was involved in an underlying crime related to Russian election interference. Although the obstruction statutes do not require proof of such a crime, the absence of that evidence affects the analysis of the president's intent and requires consideration of other possible motives for his conduct. Third, many of the president's acts directed at witnesses, including discouragement of cooperation with the government and suggestions of possible future pardons, took place in public view. That circumstance is unusual, but no principle of law excludes public acts from the reach of the obstruction laws. If the likely effect of public acts is to influence witnesses or alter their testimony, the harm to the justice system's integrity is the same. Although the series of events we investigated involved discrete acts, the overall pattern of the president's conduct towards the investigations can shed light on the nature of the president's acts and the inferences that can be drawn about his intent. In particular, the actions we investigated can be divided into two phases, reflecting a possible shift in the president's motives. The first phase covered the period from the president's first interactions with Comey through the president's firing of Comey. During that time, the president had been repeatedly told he was not personally under investigation. Soon after the firing of Comey and the appointment of the special counsel, however, the president became aware that his own conduct was being investigated in an obstruction of justice inquiry. At that point, the president engaged in a second phase of conduct involving public attacks on the investigation, non-public efforts to control it, and efforts in both public and private to encourage witnesses not to cooperate with the investigation. Judgments about the nature of the president's motives during each phase would be informed by the totality of the evidence. Statutory and constitutional defenses. The president's counsel raised statutory and constitutional defenses to a possible obstruction of justice analysis of the conduct we investigated. We concluded that none of these legal defenses provided a basis for declining to investigate the facts. Statutory defenses. Consistent with precedent and the Department of Justice's general approach to interpreting obstruction statutes, we concluded that several statutes could apply here. See 18 U.S.C. et sequentia 1503, 1505, 1512 B3, 1512 C2. Sections 1512 C2 is an omnibus obstruction of justice provision that covers a range of obstructive acts directed at pending or contemplated official proceedings. No principle of statutory construction justifies narrowing the provision to cover only conduct that impairs the integrity or availability of evidence. Sections 1503 and 1505 also offer broad protection against obstructive acts directed at pending grand jury, judicial, administrative, and congressional proceedings, and they are supplemented by a provision in Section 1512B aimed specifically at conduct intended to prevent or hinder the communication to law enforcement of information related to a federal crime. Constitutional defenses. As for constitutional defenses arising from the president's status as the head of the executive branch, we recognized that the Department of Justice and the courts have not definitively resolved these issues. We therefore examined those issues through the framework established by Supreme Court precedent governing separation of powers issues. The Department of Justice and the President's personal counsel have recognized that the President is subject to statutes that prohibit obstruction of justice by bribing a witness or suborning perjury because that conduct does not implicate his constitutional authority. With respect to whether the President can be found to have obstructed justice by exercising his powers under Article 2 of the Constitution, we concluded that Congress has authority to prohibit a president's corrupt use of his authority in order to protect the integrity of the administration of justice. Under applicable Supreme Court precedent, the Constitution does not categorically and permanently immunize a president for obstructing justice through the use of his Article II powers. The separation of powers doctrine authorizes Congress to protect official proceedings, including those of courts and grand juries, from corrupt, obstructive acts, regardless of their source. We also concluded that any inroad on presidential authority that would occur from prohibiting corrupt acts does not undermine the president's ability to fulfill his constitutional mission. The term corruptly sets a demanding standard. It requires a concrete showing that a person acted with an intent to obtain an improper advantage for himself or someone else, inconsistent with official duty and the rights of others. A preclusion of, quote, corrupt, unquote, official action does not diminish the president's ability to exercise Article II powers. For example, the proper supervision of criminal law does not demand freedom for the president to act with a corrupt intention of shielding himself from criminal punishment, avoiding financial liability, or preventing personal embarrassment. To the contrary, a statute that prohibits official action undertaken for such corrupt purposes furthers, rather than hinders, the impartial and even-handed administration of the law. It also aligns with the president's constitutional duty to faithfully execute the laws. Finally, we concluded that in the rare case in which a criminal investigation of the president's conduct is justified, inquiries to determine whether the president acted for a corrupt motive should not impermissibly chill his performance of his constitutionally assigned duties. The conclusion that Congress may apply the obstruction laws to the president's corrupt exercise of the powers of office accords with our constitutional system of checks and balances and the principle that no person is above the law. Conclusion. Because we determined not to make a traditional prosecutorial judgment, we did not draw ultimate conclusions about the president's conduct. The evidence we obtained about the president's actions and intent presents difficult issues that would need to be resolved if we were making a traditional prosecutorial judgment. At the same time, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, we are unable to reach that judgment. Accordingly, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. 1. Background legal and evidentiary principles. A. Legal framework of obstruction of justice. The May 17, 2017 appointment order and the special counsel regulations provide this office with jurisdiction to investigate, quote, federal crimes committed in the course of and with intent to interfere with the special counsel's investigation, such as perjury, obstruction of justice, destruction of evidence, and intimidation of witnesses. 28 CFR Section 600.4a. Because of that description of our jurisdiction, we sought evidence for our obstruction of justice investigation with the elements of obstruction offenses in mind. Our evidentiary analysis is similarly focused on the elements of such offenses, although we do not draw conclusions on the ultimate questions that govern a prosecutorial decision under the principles of federal prosecution. See Justice Manual, Section 9-27.000, et seq., 2018. Here, we summarize the law interpreting the elements of potentially relevant obstruction statutes in an ordinary case. This discussion does not address the unique constitutional issues that arise in an inquiry into official acts by the president. Those issues are discussed in a later section of this report, addressing constitutional defenses that the president's counsel have raised. See Volume 2, Section 3.B, Infra. Three basic elements are common to most of the relevant obstruction statutes. 1. An obstructive act. 2. A nexus between the obstructive act and an official proceeding. And 3. A corrupt intent. See, e.g., 18 U.S.C., Sections 1503, 1505, and 1512, C2. We describe those elements as they have been interpreted by the courts. We then discuss a more specific statute aimed at witness tampering, see 18 U.S.C., Section 1512b, and describe the requirements for attempted offenses and endeavors to obstruct justice, see 18 U.S.C., Sections 1503 and 1512 C2. Obstructive Act. Obstruction of justice law, quote, reaches all corrupt conduct capable of producing an effect that prevents justice from being duly administered, regardless of the means employed, unquote. United States v. Silverman, 745 F. 2nd, 1386 and 1393, 11th Circuit, 1984, interpreting 18 U.S.C., Section 1503. An, quote, effort to influence, unquote, a proceeding can qualify as an endeavor to obstruct justice, even if the effort was, quote, subtle or circuitous, unquote, and, quote, however cleverly or with whatever cloaking of purpose, unquote, it was made. United States v. Roe, 529 F. 2nd, 629 and 632, 4th Circuit, 1975. See also United States v. Quatron, 441 F. 3rd, 153, 173, 2nd Circuit, 2006. The verbs, quote, obstruct or impede are broad, unquote, and, quote, can refer to anything that blocks, makes difficult, or hinders, unquote. Marinello v. United States, 138 S. Court, 1101-1106, 2018. Internal brackets and quotation marks omitted. An improper motive can render an actor's conduct criminal, even when the conduct would otherwise be lawful and within the actor's authority. See United States v. Cueto, 151 F. 3rd, 620, 631, 7th Circuit, 1998, affirming obstruction conviction of a criminal defense attorney for, quote, litigation-related conduct, unquote. United States v. Cintolo, 818 F. 2nd, 980, 992, 1st Circuit, 1987, quote, any act by any party, whether lawful or unlawful on its face, may abridge Section 1503 if performed with a corrupt motive. Nexus to a pending or contemplated official proceeding. Obstruction of justice law generally requires a nexus or connection to an official proceeding. In Section 1503, the nexus must be to pending, quote, judicial or grand jury proceedings, unquote. United States v. Aguilar, 515, U.S. 593, 599, 1995. In Section 1505, the nexus can include a connection to a, quote, pending, unquote, federal agency proceeding or a congressional inquiry or investigation. Under both statutes, the government must demonstrate, quote, a relationship in time, causation, or logic, unquote, between the obstructive act and the proceeding or inquiry to be obstructed. Id at 599. See also Arthur Anderson LLP v. United States, 544 U.S. 696, 707-708, 2005. Section 1512C prohibits obstructive efforts aimed at official proceedings, including judicial or grand jury proceedings. 18 U.S.C. Section 1515A1A. Quote, for purposes of, unquote, Section 1512, quote, "An official proceeding need not be pending or about to be instituted at the time of the offense," unquote. 18 U.S.C. Section 1512 F1. Although a proceeding need not be already in progress to trigger liability under Section 1512 C, a nexus to a contemplated proceeding still must be shown. United States v. Young, 916 F3rd 368-386, 4th Circuit, 2019, United States v. Petrick, 781 F3rd 438-445, 8th Circuit, 2015, United States v. Phillips, 583 F3rd 1261-1264, 10th Circuit, 2009, United States v. Reich, 479 F3rd 179-186, 2nd Circuit, 2007. The nexus requirement narrows the scope of obstruction statutes to ensure that individuals have, quote, fair warning, unquote, of what the law prescribes. Aguilar, 515 U.S. at 600. Internal quotation marks omitted. The nexus showing has subjective and objective components. As an objective matter, a defendant must act, quote, in a manner that is likely to obstruct justice, unquote, such that the statute, quote, excludes defendants who have an evil purpose, but use means that would only unnaturally and improbably be successful, unquote. Aguilar, 515 U.S. at 601 to 602. Emphasis added. Internal quotation marks omitted. The endeavor must have the natural and probable effect of interfering with the due administration of justice. Id at 599. Citation and internal quotation marks omitted. As a subjective matter, the actor must have contemplated a particular foreseeable proceeding. Petrick, 781 F3rd at 445 to 446. A defendant need not directly impede the proceeding. Rather, a nexus exists if, quote, discretionary actions of a third person would be required to obstruct the judicial proceeding if it was foreseeable to the defendant that the third party would act on the defendant's communication in such a way as to obstruct the judicial proceeding. United States v. Martinez, 862 F3rd 223-238, 2nd Circuit, 2017. Brackets, ellipses, and internal quotation marks omitted. Corruptly. The word corruptly provides the intent element for obstruction of justice and means acting, quote, knowingly and dishonestly, unquote, or, quote, with an improper motive, unquote. United States v. Richardson, 676 F3rd 491-508, 5th Circuit, 2012. United States v. Gordon, 710 F3rd 1124-1151, 10th Circuit, 2013. To act corruptly means to, quote, act with an improper purpose and to engage in conduct knowingly and dishonestly, with the specific intent to subvert, impede, or obstruct, unquote, the relevant proceeding. Some quotation marks omitted. See 18 U.S.C. Section 1515b. Quote, as used in Section 1505, the term corruptly means acting with an improper purpose, personally or by influencing another, unquote. See also Arthur Anderson, 544 U.S. at 705 to 706, interpreting corruptly to mean, quote, wrongful, immoral, depraved, or evil, unquote, and holding that acting, quote, knowingly, corruptly, unquote, in 18 U.S.C. Section 1512b requires, quote, consciousness of wrongdoing, unquote. The requisite showing is made when a person acted with an intent to obtain an, quote, improper advantage for himself or someone else inconsistent with official duty and the rights of others. Unquote. Ballantyne's Law Dictionary, 276, 3rd edition, 1969. See United States v. Pasha, 797 F3rd, 1122, 1132, D.C. Circuit, 2015. Aguilar, 515 U.S. at 616. Scalia, J., concurring in part and dissenting in part, characterizing this definition as the, quote, long-standing and well-accepted meaning, unquote, of, quote, corruptly, unquote. Witness tampering. A more specific provision in Section 1512 prohibits tampering with a witness. See 18 U.S.C. Section 1512b1, 3, making it a crime to, quote, knowingly use intimidation or corruptly persuade another person, unquote, or, quote, engage in misleading conduct towards another person, unquote, with the intent to, quote, influence, delay, or prevent the testimony of any person in an official proceeding, unquote, or to, quote, hinder, delay, or prevent the communication to a law enforcement officer of information relating to the commission or possible commission of a federal offense, unquote. To establish corrupt persuasion, it is sufficient that the defendant ask a potential witness to lie to investigators in contemplation of a likely federal investigation into his conduct. United States v. Edlund, 887 F3rd, 166-174, 4th Circuit, 2018. United States v. Sparks, 791 F3rd, 1188-1191-1192, 10th Circuit, 2015. United States v. Byrne, 435 F3rd, 16-23-26, 1st Circuit, 2006. United States v. Lachey, 417 F3rd, 715, 718 to 719, 7th Circuit, 2005. United States v. Burns, 298 F3rd, 523, 539 to 540, 6th Circuit, 2002. United States v. Pennington, 168 F3rd, 1060, 1066, 8th Circuit, 1999. The, quote, persuasion, unquote, need not be coercive, intimidating, or explicit. It is sufficient to, quote, urge, unquote, quote, induce, unquote, quote, ask, unquote, quote, argue, unquote, quote, give reasons, unquote. Sparks, 791 F3rd at 1192. Or, quote, coach or remind witnesses by planting misleading facts, unquote. Edlund, 887 F3rd at 174. Corrupt persuasion is shown, quote, where a defendant tells a potential witness a false story as if the story were true, intending that the witness believe the story and testify to it. United States v. Rodelitz, 786 F2nd, 77-82, 2nd Circuit, 1986. See United States v. Gabriel, 125 F3rd, 89-102, 2nd Circuit, 1997. It also covers urging a witness to recall a fact that the witness did not know, even if the fact was actually true. See Lachey, 417 F3rd at 719. Corrupt persuasion also can be shown in certain circumstances when a person, with an improper motive, urges a witness not to cooperate with law enforcement. See United States v. Schatz, 145 F3rd, 1289-1301, 11th Circuit, 1998. Telling secretary, quote, not to say anything to the FBI and she would not be bothered, unquote. When the charge is acting with the intent to hinder, delay, or prevent the communication of information to law enforcement, under Section 1512b3, the, quote, nexus, unquote, to a preceding inquiry articulated in Aguilar, that an individual have, quote, knowledge that his actions are likely to affect the judicial proceeding, unquote, 515 U.S. at 599, does not apply because the obstructive act is aimed at the communication of information to investigators, not at impeding an official proceeding. Acting, quote, knowingly, corruptly, unquote, requires proof that the individual was, quote, conscious of wrongdoing, unquote. Arthur Anderson, 544 U.S. at 705 to 706, declining to explore, quote, the outer limits of this element, unquote, but indicating that an instruction was infirm where it permitted conviction even if the defendant, quote, honestly and sincerely believed that the conduct was lawful, unquote. It is an affirmative defense that, quote, the conduct consisted solely of lawful conduct and that the defendant's sole intention was to encourage, induce, or cause the other person to testify truthfully, unquote. 18 U.S.C. Section 1512E. Attempts and Endeavors. Section 1512C2 covers both substantive obstruction offenses and attempts to obstruct justice. Under general principles of attempt law, a person is guilty of an attempt when he has the intent to commit a substantive offense and takes an overt act that constitutes a substantial step towards that goal. See United States v. Raison de Ponce, 549 U.S. 102, 106-107, 2007. Quote, the act must be substantial in that it was strongly corroborative of the defendant's criminal purpose, unquote. United States v. Pratt, 351 F3rd, 131, 135, 4th Circuit, 2003. While, quote, mere abstract talk, unquote, does not suffice, any, quote, concrete and specific, unquote, acts that corroborate the defendant's intent can constitute a, quote, substantial step, unquote. United States v. Irving, 665 F3rd, 1184, 1198-1205, 10th Circuit, 2011. Thus, quote, soliciting an innocent agent to engage in conduct constituting an element of the crime, unquote, may qualify as a substantial step. Model Penal Code, Section 5.01, 2G. See United States v. Lucas, 499 F3rd, 769, 781, 8th Circuit, 2007. The Omnibus Clause of 18 U.S.C. Section 1503 prohibits an, quote, endeavor, unquote, to obstruct justice, which sweeps more broadly than Section 1512's attempt provision. See United States v. Sampson, 898 F3rd, 287, 302, 2nd Circuit, 2018, United States v. Leisure, 844 F2nd, 1347, 1366-1367, 8th Circuit, 1988, collecting cases. Quote, it is well established that an obstruction of justice offense is complete when one corruptly endeavors to obstruct or impede the due administration of justice. The prosecution need not prove that the due administration of justice was actually obstructed or impeded. United States v. Davis, 854 F3rd, 1276, 1292, 11th Circuit, 2017. Internal quotation marks omitted. B. Investigative and evidentiary considerations. After the appointment of the special counsel, this office obtained evidence about the following events relating to potential issues of obstruction of justice involving the president. A. The President's January 27, 2017 dinner with former FBI Director James Comey, in which the President reportedly asked for Comey's loyalty, one day after the White House had been briefed by the Department of Justice on contacts between former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and the Russian ambassador. B. The president's February 14, 2017 meeting with Comey, in which the president reportedly asked Comey not to pursue an investigation of Flynn. C. The president's private requests to Comey to make public the fact that the president was not the subject of an FBI investigation and to lift what the president regarded as a cloud. D. The president's outreach to the Director of National Intelligence and the directors of the National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency about the FBI's Russia investigation. E. The president's stated rationales for terminating Comey on May 9, 2017, including statements that could reasonably be understood as acknowledging that the FBI's Russia investigation was a factor in Comey's termination. And F. The president's reported involvement in issuing a statement about the June 9, 2016 Trump Tower meeting between Russians and senior Trump campaign officials that said the meeting was about adoption and omitted that the Russians had offered to provide the Trump campaign with derogatory information about Hillary Clinton. Taking into account that information and our analysis of applicable statutory and constitutional principles discussed below in Volume 2, Section 3, Infra, we determined that there was a sufficient factual and legal basis to further investigate potential obstruction of justice issues involving the president. Many of the core issues in an obstruction of justice investigation turn on an individual's actions and intent. We therefore requested that the White House provide us with documentary evidence in its possession on the relevant events. We also sought and obtained the White House's concurrence in our conducting interviews of White House personnel who had relevant information. And we interviewed other witnesses who had pertinent knowledge, obtained documents on a voluntary basis when possible, and used legal process where appropriate. These investigative steps allowed us to gather a substantial amount of evidence. We also sought a voluntary interview with the president. After more than a year of discussion, the president declined to be interviewed. Redaction, grand jury. During the course of our discussions, the president did agree to answer written questions on certain Russia-related topics, and he provided us with answers. He did not similarly agree to provide written answers to questions on obstruction topics or questions on events during the transition. Ultimately, while we believe that we had the authority and legal justification to issue a grand jury subpoena to obtain the president's testimony, we chose not to do so. We made that decision in view of the substantial delay that such an investigative step would likely produce at a late stage in our investigation. We also assessed that, based on the significant body of evidence we had already obtained of the president's actions and his public and private statements describing or explaining those actions, we had sufficient evidence to understand relevant events and to make certain assessments without the president's testimony. The office's decision-making process on this issue is described in more detail in Appendix C, Infra, in a note that precedes the president's written responses. In assessing the evidence we obtained, we relied on common principles that apply in any investigation. The issue of criminal intent is often inferred from circumstantial evidence. See, e.g., United States v. Croteau, 819 F3rd, 1293, 1305, 11th Circuit, 2016. Quote, guilty knowledge can rarely be established by direct evidence. Therefore, mens rea elements, such as knowledge or intent, may be proved by circumstantial evidence. Unquote. Internal quotation marks omitted. United States v. Robinson, 702 F3rd 2236, 2nd Circuit, 2012. Quote, the government's case rested on circumstantial evidence, but the mens rea elements of knowledge and intent can often be proved through circumstantial evidence and the reasonable inferences drawn therefrom. unquote. Internal quotation marks omitted. The principle that intent can be inferred from circumstantial evidence is a necessity in criminal cases, given the right of a subject to assert his privilege against compelled self-incrimination under the Fifth Amendment, and therefore decline to testify. Accordingly, determinations on intent are frequently reached without the opportunity to interview an investigatory subject. Obstruction of justice cases are consistent with this rule. See, e.g., Edlund, 887 F3rd at 174-176, relying on, quote, significant circumstantial evidence that the defendant was conscious of her wrongdoing, unquote, in an obstruction case. Quote, because evidence of intent will almost always be circumstantial. A defendant may be found culpable where the reasonable and foreseeable consequences of her acts are the obstruction of justice, unquote. Internal quotation marks, ellipses, and punctuation omitted. Quattrone, 441 F3rd at 173-174. Circumstantial evidence that illuminates intent may include a pattern of potentially obstructive acts. Federal Rules of Evidence, 404B, quote, evidence of a crime, wrong, or other act may be admissible to prove motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, absence of mistake, or lack of accident, unquote. See, e.g., United States v. Frankhauser, 80 F3rd 641, 648-650, 1st Circuit, 1996, United States v. Arnold, 773 F2nd 823, 832-834, 7th Circuit, 1985, Cintolo, 818 F2nd at 1000. Credibility judgments may also be made based on objective facts and circumstantial evidence. Standard jury instructions highlight a variety of factors that are often relevant in assessing credibility. These include whether a witness has a reason not to tell the truth, whether the witness has a good memory, whether the witness had the opportunity to observe the events about which he testified, whether the witness's testimony was corroborated by other witnesses, and whether anything the witness said or wrote previously contradicts his testimony. See, e.g., First Circuit Pattern Jury Instructions, Section 1.06, 2018. Fifth Circuit Pattern Jury Instructions, Criminal Cases, Section 1.08, 2012. Seventh Circuit Pattern Jury Instructions, Section 3.01, 2012. In addition to these general factors, we took into account more specific factors in assessing the credibility of conflicting accounts of the facts. For example, contemporaneous written notes can provide strong corroborating evidence. See United States v. Nobles, 422 U.S. 225, 232, 1975. The fact that a, quote, statement appeared in the contemporaneously recorded report would tend strongly to corroborate the investigator's version of the interview, unquote. Similarly, a witness's recitation of his account before he had any motive to fabricate also supports the witness's credibility. See Tome v. United States, 513 U.S. 150, 158, 1995. Quote, a consistent statement that predates the motive is a square rebuttal of the charge that the testimony was contrived as a consequence of that motive. Unquote. Finally, a witness's false description of an encounter can imply consciousness of wrongdoing. See Al-Adahi v. Obama, 613 F3rd, 1102-1107, D.C. Circuit, 2010, noting the, quote, well-settled principle that false, exculpatory statements are evidence, often strong evidence, of guilt, unquote. We applied those settled legal principles in evaluating the factual results of our investigation. 2. Factual results of the obstruction investigation. This section of the report details the evidence we obtained. We first provide an overview of how Russia became an issue in the 2016 presidential campaign and how candidate Trump responded. We then turn to the key events that we investigated: the president's conduct concerning the FBI investigation of Michael Flynn, the president's reaction to public confirmation of the FBI's Russia investigation, events leading up to and surrounding the termination of FBI Director Comey, efforts to terminate the special counsel, efforts to curtail the scope of the special counsel's investigation, efforts to prevent disclosure of information about the June 9, 2016 Trump Tower meeting between Russians and senior campaign officials, efforts to have the Attorney General unrecuse, and conduct towards McGahn, Cohen, and other witnesses. We summarize the evidence we found and then analyze it by reference to the three statutory obstruction of justice elements: obstructive act, nexus to a proceeding, and intent. We focus on elements because, by regulation, the special counsel has, quote, jurisdiction to investigate federal crimes committed in the course of and with the intent to interfere with the special counsel's investigation, such as perjury, obstruction of justice, destruction of evidence, and intimidation of witnesses, unquote. 28 CFR, section 600.4a. Consistent with our jurisdiction to investigate federal obstruction crimes, we gathered evidence that is relevant to the elements of those crimes and analyzed them within an elements framework, while refraining from reaching ultimate conclusions about whether crimes were committed, for the reasons explained. This section also does not address legal and constitutional defenses raised by counsel for the president. Those defenses are analyzed in Volume 2, Section 3, Infra. A. The campaign's response to reports about Russian support for Trump. During the 2016 campaign, the media raised questions about a possible connection between the Trump campaign and Russia. Footnote 7. The questions intensified after WikiLeaks released politically damaging Democratic Party emails that were reported to have been hacked by Russia. Trump responded to questions about possible connections to Russia by denying any business involvement in Russia, even though the Trump Organization had pursued a business project in Russia as late as June 2016. Trump also expressed skepticism that Russia had hacked the emails, at the same time as he and other campaign advisors privately sought information, redaction, harm to ongoing matter, about any further planned WikiLeaks releases. After the election, when questions persisted about possible links between Russia and the Trump campaign, the president-elect continued to deny any connections to Russia and privately expressed concerns that reports of Russian election interference might lead the public to question the legitimacy of his election. Footnote 8. 1. Press reports allege links between the Trump campaign and Russia. On June 16, 2015, Donald J. Trump declared his intent to seek nomination as the Republican candidate for president. Footnote 9. By early 2016, he distinguished himself among Republican candidates by speaking of closer ties with Russia. Footnote 10. Saying he would get along well with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Footnote 11. Questioning whether the NATO alliance was obsolete. Footnote 12. And praising Putin as a, quote, strong leader, unquote. Footnote 13. The press reported that Russian political analysts and commentators perceived Trump as favorable to Russia. Footnote 14. Beginning in February 2016 and continuing through this summer, the media reported that several Trump campaign advisors appeared to have ties to Russia. For example, the press reported that campaign advisor Michael Flynn was seated next to Vladimir Putin at an RT gala in Moscow in December 2015, and that Flynn had appeared regularly on RT as an analyst. Footnote 15. The press also reported that foreign policy adviser Carter Page had ties to a Russian state-run gas company. Footnote 16. And that campaign chairman Paul Manafort had done work for the, quote, Russian-backed former Ukrainian president Viktor Yanukovych, unquote. Footnote 17. In addition, the press raised questions during the Republican National Convention about the Trump campaign's involvement in changing the Republican platform's stance on giving, quote, weapons to Ukraine to fight Russian and rebel forces, unquote. Footnote 18. 2. The Trump campaign reacts to WikiLeaks' release of hacked emails. On June 14, 2016, a cybersecurity firm that had conducted in-house analysis for the Democratic National Committee, DNC, posted an announcement that Russian government hackers had infiltrated the DNC's computer and obtained access to documents. Footnote 19. On July 22, 2016, the day before the Democratic National Convention, WikiLeaks posted thousands of hacked DNC documents revealing sensitive internal deliberations. Footnote 20. Soon thereafter, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager publicly contended that Russia had hacked the DNC emails and arranged their release in order to help candidate Trump. Footnote 21. On July 26, 2016, the New York Times reported that U.S., quote, intelligence agencies had told the White House they now have high confidence that the Russian government was behind the theft of emails and documents from the Democratic National Committee. Footnote 22. Within the Trump campaign, aides reacted with enthusiasm to reports of the hacks. Footnote 23. Redaction, harm to ongoing matter, discussed with campaign officials that WikiLeaks would release the hacked material. Footnote 24. Some witnesses said that Trump himself discussed the possibility of upcoming releases. Redaction, harm to ongoing matter. Michael Cohen, then executive vice president of the Trump Organization and special counsel to Trump, recalled hearing, redaction, harm to ongoing matter, including footnote 25. Cohen recalled that Trump responded, oh, good, all right, and redaction, harm to ongoing matter, including footnote 26. Manafort said that shortly after WikiLeaks' July 22, 2016 release of hacked documents, he spoke to Trump, redaction, harm to ongoing matter. Manafort recalled that Trump responded that Manafort should, redaction, harm to ongoing matter, keep Trump updated. Footnote 27. Deputy campaign manager Rick Gates said that Manafort was getting pressure about, redaction, harm to ongoing matter, information, and that Manafort instructed Gates, redaction, harm to ongoing matter, status updates on upcoming releases. Footnote 28. Around the same time, Gates was with Trump on a trip to an airport, redaction, harm to ongoing matter. And shortly after the call ended, Trump told Gates that more releases of damaging information would be coming. Footnote 29. Redaction, harm to ongoing matter, were discussed within the campaign. Footnote 30. And in the summer of 2016, the campaign was planning a communication strategy based on the possible release of Clinton emails by WikiLeaks. Footnote 31. 3. The Trump campaign reacts to allegations that Russia was seeking to aid candidate Trump. In the days that followed WikiLeaks' July 22, 2016 release of hacked DNC emails, the Trump campaign publicly rejected suggestions that Russia was seeking to aid candidate Trump. On July 26, 2016, Trump tweeted that it was, quote, crazy, unquote, to suggest that Russia was, quote, dealing with Trump, unquote. Footnote 32, and that, quote, for the record, unquote, he had, quote, zero investments in Russia, unquote. footnote 33. In a press conference the next day, July 27, 2016, Trump characterized, quote, this whole thing with Russia, unquote, as, quote, a total deflection, unquote, and stated that it was, quote, far-fetched, unquote, and, quote, ridiculous, unquote. Footnote 34. Trump said that the assertion that Russia had hacked the emails was unproven, but stated that it would give him, quote, no pause, unquote, if Russia had Clinton's emails. Footnote 35. Trump added, Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press. Footnote 36. Trump also said that, there's nothing that I can think of that I'd rather do than have Russia friendly, as opposed to the way they are right now. And in response to a question about whether he would recognize Crimea as Russian territory and consider lifting sanctions, Trump replied, we'll be looking at that. Yeah, we'll be looking. Footnote 37. During the press conference, Trump repeated, I have nothing to do with Russia, 5 times. Footnote 38. He stated that, quote, the closest he came to Russia, unquote, was that Russians may have purchased a home or condos from him. Footnote 39. He said that after he held the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow in 2013, he had been interested in working with Russian companies that, quote, wanted to put a lot of money into developments in Russia, unquote, but, quote, it never worked out, unquote. Footnote 40. He explained, frankly, I didn't want to do it for a couple of different reasons, but we had a major developer that wanted to develop property in Moscow and other places, but we decided not to do it. Footnote 41. The Trump Organization, however, had been pursuing a building project in Moscow, the Trump Tower Moscow project, from approximately September 2015 through June 2016, and the candidate was regularly updated on developments, including possible trips by Michael Cohen to Moscow to promote the deal and by Trump himself to finalize it. Footnote 42. Cohen recalled speaking with Trump after the press conference about Trump's denial of any business dealings in Russia, which Cohen regarded as untrue. Footnote 43. Trump told Cohen that Trump Tower Moscow was not a deal yet and said, why mention it if it is not a deal? Footnote 44. According to Cohen, at around this time, in response to Trump's disavowal of connections to Russia, campaign advisors had developed a, quote, party line, unquote, that Trump had no business with Russia and no connections to Russia. Footnote 45. In addition to denying any connections with Russia, the Trump campaign reacted to reports of Russian election interference in aid of the campaign by seeking to distance itself from Russian contacts. For example, in August 2016, Foreign Policy Advisor J.D. Gordon declined an invitation to Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak's residence because the timing was, quote, not optimal, unquote, in view of media reports about Russian interference. Footnote 46. On August 19, 2016, Manafort was asked to resign amid media coverage scrutinizing his ties to a pro-Russian political party in Ukraine and links to Russian business. Footnote 47. And when the media published stories about Page's connections to Russia in September 2016, Trump campaign officials terminated Page's association with the campaign and told the press that he had played, quote, no role, unquote, in the campaign. Footnote 48. On October 7, 2016, WikiLeaks released the first set of emails stolen by a Russian intelligence agency from Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta. Footnote 49. The same day, the federal government announced that, quote, the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from U.S. persons and institutions, including from U.S. political organizations, unquote. Footnote 50. The government statement directly linked Russian hacking to the releases on WikiLeaks, with the goal of interfering with the presidential election, and concluded, quote, that only Russia's senior-most officials could have authorized these activities, unquote, based on their, quote, scope and sensitivity, unquote. Footnote 51. On October 11, 2016, Podesta stated publicly that the FBI was investigating Russia's hacking and said that candidate Trump might have known in advance that the hacked emails were going to be released. Footnote 52. Vice presidential candidate Mike Pence was asked whether the Trump campaign was, quote, in cahoots, unquote, with WikiLeaks in releasing damaging Clinton-related information, and responded, nothing could be further from the truth. Footnote 53. 4. After the election, Trump continues to deny any contacts or connections with Russia, or that Russia aided his election. On November 8, 2016, Trump was elected president. 2 days later, Russian officials told the press that the Russian government had maintained contacts with Trump's, quote, immediate entourage, unquote, during the campaign. Footnote 54. In response, Hope Hicks, who had been the Trump campaign spokesperson, said, we are not aware of any campaign representatives that were in touch with any foreign entities before yesterday, when Mr. Trump spoke with many world leaders. Footnote 55. Hicks gave an additional statement denying any contacts between the campaign and Russia. It never happened. There was no communication between the campaign and any foreign entity during the campaign. Footnote 56. On December 10, 2016, the press reported that U.S. intelligence agencies had, quote, concluded that Russia interfered in last month's presidential election to boost Donald Trump's bid for the White House, unquote. Footnote 57. Reacting to the story the next day, President-elect Trump stated, I think it's ridiculous. I think it's just another excuse. Footnote 58. He continued that no one really knew who was responsible for the hacking, suggesting that the intelligence community had, quote, no idea if it's Russia or China or somebody. It could be somebody sitting in a bed someplace, unquote. Footnote 59. The president-elect also said that Democrats were, quote, putting out, unquote, the story of Russian interference, quote, because they suffered one of the greatest defeats in the history of politics, unquote. Footnote 60. On December 18, 2016, Podesta told the press that the election was, quote, distorted by the Russian intervention, unquote, and questioned whether Trump campaign officials had been, quote, in touch with the Russians, unquote. Footnote 61. The same day, incoming Chief of Staff Reince Priebus appeared on Fox News Sunday and declined to say whether the president-elect accepted the intelligence community's determination that Russia intervened in the election. Footnote 62. When asked about any contact or coordination between the campaign and Russia, Priebus said, even this question is insane. Of course we didn't interface with the Russians. Footnote 63. Priebus added that this whole thing is a spin job and said, the real question is why the Democrats are doing everything they can to delegitimize the outcome of the election. Footnote 64. On December 29, 2016, the Obama administration announced that in response to Russian cyber operations aimed at the U.S. election, it was imposing sanctions and other measures on several Russian individuals and entities. Footnote 65. When first asked about the sanctions, President-elect Trump said, I think we ought to get on with our lives. Footnote 66. He then put out a statement that said, it's time for our country to move on to bigger and better things, but indicated that he would meet with intelligence community leaders the following week for a briefing on Russian interference. Footnote 67. The briefing occurred on January 6, 2017. Footnote 68. Following the briefing, the intelligence community released the public version of its assessment, which concluded with high confidence that Russia had intervened in the election through a variety of means with the goal of harming Clinton's electability. Footnote 69. The assessment further concluded, with high confidence, that Putin and the Russian government had developed a clear preference for Trump. Footnote 70. Several days later, BuzzFeed published unverified allegations compiled by former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele during the campaign about candidate Trump's Russia connections under the headline, "These reports allege Trump has deep ties to Russia." Footnote 71. In a press conference the next day, the president-elect called the release, quote, "an absolute disgrace," unquote, and said, "I have no dealings with Russia. I have no deals that could happen in Russia because we've stayed away. So I have no deals. I have no loans and I have no dealings. We could make deals in Russia very easily if we wanted to. I just don't want to because I think that would be a conflict." Footnote 72. Several advisers recalled that the president-elect viewed stories about his Russian connections, the Russia investigations, and the intelligence community assessment of Russian interference as a threat to the legitimacy of his electoral victory. Footnote 73. Hicks, for example, said that the president-elect viewed the intelligence community assessment as his Achilles heel, because even if Russia had no impact on the election, people would think Russia helped him win, taking away from what he had accomplished. Footnote 74. Sean Spicer, the first White House communications director, recalled that the president thought the Russia story was developed to undermine the legitimacy of his election. Footnote 75. Gates said the president viewed the Russia investigation as an attack on the legitimacy of his win. Footnote 76. And Priebus recalled that when the intelligence assessment came out, the president-elect was concerned people would question the legitimacy of his win. Footnote 77. B. The president's conduct concerning the investigation of Michael Flynn. Overview. During the presidential transition, incoming National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had two phone calls with the Russian ambassador to the United States about the Russian response to U.S. sanctions imposed because of Russia's election interference. After the press reported on Flynn's contacts with the Russian ambassador, Flynn lied to incoming administration officials by saying he had not discussed sanctions on the calls. The officials publicly repeated those lies in press interviews. The FBI, which previously was investigating Flynn for other matters, interviewed him about the calls in the first week after the inauguration, and Flynn told similar lies to the FBI. On January 26, 2017, Department of Justice, DOJ, officials notified the White House that Flynn and the Russian ambassador had discussed sanctions and that Flynn had been interviewed by the FBI. The next night, the president had a private dinner with FBI Director James Comey, in which he asked for Comey's loyalty. On February 13, 2017, the president asked Flynn to resign. The following day, the president had a one-on-one conversation with Comey, in which he said, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go." Evidence. 1. Incoming National Security Advisor Flynn discusses sanctions on Russia with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Shortly after the election, President-elect Trump announced he would appoint Michael Flynn as his National Security Advisor. Footnote 78. For the next 2 months, Flynn played an active role on the Presidential Transition Team, PTT, coordinating policy positions and communicating with foreign government officials, including Russian Ambassador to the United States, Sergei Kislyak. On December 29, 2016, as noted in Volume 2, Section 2A4, Sutra, the Obama administration announced that it was imposing sanctions and other measures on several Russian individuals and entities. Footnote 80. That day, multiple members of the PTT exchanged emails about the sanctions and the impact they would have on the incoming administration, and Flynn informed members of the PTT that he would be speaking to the Russian ambassador later in the day. Footnote 81. Flynn, who was in the Dominican Republic at the time, and K.T. McFarland, who was slated to become the Deputy National Security Advisor and was at the Mar-a-Lago Resort in Florida with the president-elect and other senior staff, talked by phone about what, if anything, Flynn should communicate to Kislyak about the sanctions. Footnote 82. McFarland had spoken with incoming administration officials about the sanctions and Russia's possible responses, and thought she had mentioned in those conversations that Flynn was scheduled to speak with Kislyak. Footnote 83. Based on those conversations, McFarland informed Flynn that incoming administration officials at Mar-a-Lago did not want Russia to escalate the situation. Footnote 84. At 4:43 p.m. that afternoon, McFarland sent an email to several officials about the sanctions and informed the group that General Flynn is talking to Russian ambassador this evening. Footnote 85. Approximately 1 hour later, McFarland met with the president-elect and senior officials and briefed them on the sanctions and Russia's possible responses. Footnote 86. Incoming Chief of Staff Reince Priebus recalled that McFarland may have mentioned at the meeting that the sanctions situation could be, quote, cooled down, unquote, and not escalated. Footnote 87. McFarland recalled that at the end of the meeting, someone may have mentioned to the president-elect that Flynn was speaking to the Russian ambassador that evening. Footnote 88. McFarland did not recall any response by the president-elect. Footnote 89. Priebus recalled that the president-elect viewed the sanctions as an attempt by the Obama administration to embarrass him by delegitimizing his election. Footnote 90. Immediately after discussing the sanctions with McFarland on December 29, 2016, Flynn called Kislyak and requested that Russia respond to the sanctions only in a reciprocal manner, without escalating the situation. Footnote 91. After the call, Flynn briefed McFarland on its substance. Footnote 92. Flynn told McFarland that the Russian response to the sanctions was not going to be escalatory because Russia wanted a good relationship with the Trump administration. Footnote 93. On December 30, 2016, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that Russia would not take retaliatory measures in response to the sanctions at that time and would instead, quote, plan further steps to restore Russian-U.S. relations based on the policies of the Trump administration, unquote. Footnote 94. Following that announcement, the president-elect tweeted, "Great move on delay by V. Putin. I always knew he was very smart." Footnote 95. On December 31, 2016, Kislyak called Flynn and told him that Flynn's request had been received at the highest levels, and Russia had chosen not to retaliate in response to the request. Footnote 96. Later that day, Flynn told McFarland about his follow-up conversation with Kislyak and Russia's decision not to escalate the sanctions situation based on Flynn's request. Footnote 97. McFarland recalled that Flynn thought his phone call had made a difference. Footnote 98. Flynn spoke with other incoming administration officials that day, but does not recall whether they discussed the sanctions. Footnote 99. Flynn recalled discussing the sanctions issue with incoming administration official Stephen Bannon the next day. Footnote 100. Flynn said that Bannon appeared to know about Flynn's conversations with Kislyak, and he and Bannon agreed that they had, quote, stopped the train on Russia's response, unquote, to the sanctions. Footnote 101. On January 3, 2017, Flynn saw the president-elect in person and thought they discussed the Russian reaction to the sanctions, but Flynn did not have a specific recollection of telling the president-elect about the substance of his calls with Kislyak. Footnote 102. Members of the intelligence community were surprised by Russia's decision not to retaliate in response to the sanctions. Footnote 103. When analyzing Russia's response, they became aware of Flynn's discussion of sanctions with Kislyak. Footnote 104. Previously, the FBI had opened an investigation of Flynn based on his relationship with the Russian government. Footnote 105. Flynn's contacts with Kislyak became a key component of that investigation. Footnote 106. 2. President-elect Trump is briefed on the intelligence community's assessment of Russian interference in the election, and Congress opens election interference investigations. On January 6, 2017, as noted in Volume 2, Section 2A4, Supra, intelligence officials briefed President-elect Trump and the incoming administration on the intelligence community's assessment that Russia had interfered in the 2016 presidential election. Footnote 107. When the briefing concluded, Comey spoke with the president-elect privately to brief him on unverified, personally sensitive allegations compiled by Steele. Footnote 108. According to a memorandum Comey drafted immediately after their private discussion, the president-elect began the meeting by telling Comey he had conducted himself honorably over the prior year and had a great reputation. Footnote 109. The president-elect stated that he thought highly of Comey, looked forward to working with him, and hoped that he planned to stay on as FBI director. Footnote 110. Comey responded that he intended to continue serving in that role. Footnote 111. Comey then briefed the president-elect on the sensitive material in the Steele reporting. Footnote 112. Comey recalled that the president-elect seemed defensive, so Comey decided to assure him that the FBI was not investigating him personally. Footnote 113.